Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, a very special DMZ. Stay tuned, everybody. At the end of today's episode, Bill and I will have our much anticipated quadrennial, wildly premature election predictions. I'm a little nervous, Bill, but how are you holding up?
You know, there's a good phrase in Political Playbook today from a Wisconsin Democrat, nauseously optimistic.
Yes. I'm feeling about like Aaron Judge is feeling today, but we'll pull through. We'll pull through. Congrats to the Dodgers.
Did you watch the game?
Yeah, I watched a lot of the World Series. I didn't stay up for the whole thing, but Freddie Freeman, you know, MVP. And I'll tell you what, my son Beckett is 11, and he's become a baseball fanatic. And after the Orioles, we adopted the Dodgers. And it is parenthood can be tough, but I'm telling you, this is the most I've enjoyed a baseball season since I was a little kid. So it's been fun.
Interesting that, I mean, I wonder how, I think we might have talked about this way in the past, like why, like, will baseball sustain? Would young people want to get into baseball, kind of a slow-paced game when there's so many more fast-paced entertainment options available to them and attention spans whittle down? Like baseball's a game that kind of requires, you know, your attention. What do you think really captures his fancy about it?
Well, look, I tell you what, I mean, I think you're right in general, but when you get to October baseball and it's the Yankees and the Dodgers, it's exciting. It's not a slow game. It's exciting and it's romantic and the crowd, there's an energy. So while watching a game in May, against, I don't know, the Tampa Bay Rays or something, it may not be your cup of tea, man. When it gets to be October and it's the Yankees or the Red Sox or the Dodgers and Mets, that, you know, you're into something pretty special. So how could you not be romantic about baseball? Mm-hmm.
Fair enough. It seemed like the Mets gave the Dodgers a tougher time than the Yankees did.
Yeah, and look, I think some of it may be just matchups. I mean, the Orioles actually had a better winning record against the Yankees. So maybe the Orioles could have, it's not necessarily fair to say, but yeah, I think the Dodgers were the better team. Obviously they won it in five games. I think the better team won. And interestingly, Shohei Ohtani, maybe the greatest player of all time, in Major League Baseball, didn't really have a great series at all. It was other people, Freddie Freeman, Mookie Betts, I think, who really stepped up. And that's one of the things I love about baseball. Unlike, say, basketball, where you could have one star performer who just dominates, you got to have, you know, these role players. I mean, and these different stars who show up. You know, the last time the Orioles won was 83, and it wasn't Cal Ripken or Eddie Murray. It was Rick Dempsey who was the MVP that year. So that's another cool thing that I love about baseball is, you know, it's not just the one big star.
Well, the last time the Dodgers won the series, Joe Biden won the presidency. So perhaps we don't need to do predictions. Stars have already told us how it's going to turn out.
And the Washington Commanders, I don't know if you saw this, had a miraculous, Bill, miraculous win on Sunday.
I did see that clip. I saw the Hail Mary clip.
And when your Washington team wins a home game, if they win the last home game before the election, then the incumbent party wins the election. So that's good news, I think, for Kamala.
It's all said and done. We don't even have to go out and do anything. We can just
call
it a day. My
work is done. I'm out. It's, yeah. No, we should probably talk, but stay tuned. If you haven't left us with the baseball talk yet, stay tuned for our predictions. But Bill, you've been writing away. One of the things I'm interested in, because now we're, what, 4 or 5 days away from an election, somebody is going to win. I don't know when we're going to find out who the winner is. I don't know if there's going to be any sort of violence or whatever. But at some point, someone will be sworn in as president, and that will matter. And there will be policies. And like one thing I'm personally interested in is does Trump actually do tariffs if he becomes president? And does that actually cripple the economy? What does that do to agriculture or whatever? But you wrote a piece at Washington Monthly about who is more likely to actually get things done.
Yeah, I mean, I had a piece in the Washington Monthly. You know, we had a package, print issue package, about when Biden was still in the race. You know, comparing their records as president. You have two people who have been president, so you could do a fair apples to apples. And the overall thrust of the package was, regardless of your of what you wanted to see done as a, you know, you yourself, as far as what the presidents wanted to get accomplished, what their stated agendas was, that Biden had a more successful presidency. He got more of what he wanted done than Trump of what he wanted to get done. And my contribution to that package was looking at their legislative strategies, and Biden took bipartisanship much more seriously than Trump did. Now, Biden was kind of slow to it, somewhat surprisingly so, considering he has long been a paragon of bipartisanship, but he kind of tried to go FDR style early.
Yes. You may remember, Bill, that I think you and I were both thought Biden was wrong to he kind of screwed over Republicans early on and went the partisan route. I think you and I both thought that was a mistake.
Yeah. But Biden course corrected, you know, after the infrastructure bill, you know, got kind of after he hung it up, and then he said, okay, screw this, we're going to get this done without tacking on to something else. Then they pivoted and got, they got the CHIPS bill, they got the gun safety bill. There's some other things that are maybe less, you know, less attention, like post office reform. Ukraine has always been bipartisan.
No, I'm single issue post office reform, so don't downplay it. I'm a single issue voter. I'm going to say it.
Trump, as much as he's been like, you know, Mr. Art of the Deal, really never dug into the nitty gritty of how, and we talk about how transactional he is, but he never got transactional when it came to policy very much. We came to legislating. Certainly on his big ticket items, and he had an opportunity to do a deal on the wall early, and he passed on it because he didn't want to do a deal for Dreamers. So what you see in this campaign, Harris is leaning very heavily into bipartisanship. I'm going to do Biden one better. I'm going to have a Republican in my cabinet. I'm going to have a bipartisan policy council to help me formulate policy on the front end. And I'm going to campaign heavily with Republicans. I'm going to lock arms with Liz Cheney. She had an event in Pennsylvania with like 200 Republicans. Trump, I mean, to the extent that Trump's being bipartisan, it's with RFK Jr. and Tulsi Gabbard, who has renounced her membership within the Democratic Party. And it's not to say we're going to work with congressional Democrats on middle-of-the-road legislation. It's Trump saying, I'm going to let RFK go wild on medicine and food. And I don't know about you, Matt, like when I think about like the government's role in medicines, I don't want anyone to go wild on it. Like, look, this is not a go wild issue area for me. So there's nothing in how he's campaigning and nothing in the past record to suggest like whoever gets there will have a divided Congress in some respect. I mean, you could be Republican trifecta or Democratic trifecta, but it's like, but it would be narrowly so.
That's what I was going to say is the pushback, I think, to your premise is that if Trump wins, he may have a united government in the sense that I think if Trump wins the presidency, Republicans will have a slim majority in the Senate, certainly not a filibuster proof majority, but a majority in the Senate. Republicans will probably maintain control of the House. So Trump would have unified government, whereas I think it's more likely that Harris would have divided government. So I think if you are a conservative person, not a capital C, but a small C conservative type person who wants to hedge your bets and prevent either left-wing or right-wing radicalism, then Harris is probably the best way to hedge because she would be balanced most likely by a Republican Senate. Where am I wrong?
Well, I think if you are a, you know, Matt Lewis type Republican, if you're a Republican who is genuinely conservative but can't abide by Donald Trump, but is worried about Democrats going whole hog, they're not going to go whole hog. I mean, even in a narrow Democratic House, a Democratic 50-50, 51-49 Senate, I mean, look, both parties have had nominal trifectas in the past 8 years. And both times, their ability to get legislation passed was severely constrained by the moderate edge of their party. Biden was not able to go full FDR because he was constrained by Manchin and Sinema. If Democrats control the Senate this time around, it's probably going to be because, you know, John Tester pulled out something in Montana, and John Tester has been very skeptical about abolishing the filibuster. You know, that's obviously something that's on people's minds. Or he can't make it, and Colin Allred wins in Texas, and Colin Allred's not running on a hard left agenda either. And if he wants to survive in Texas, he probably can't go a hard left. So the Democratic big tent requires enough geographic distribution and even the House, you're talking about a pretty narrow margin there too. If Democrats win, that's going to have to involve a lot of folks in, you know, some reddish purplish areas. So more likely you have an actual Republican Senate with a Kamala Harris who most certainly constricts what she can do. So I don't see any scenario where Harris can really, you know, go deep left in her agenda. Now for Trump, there is maybe perhaps more of a chance that everyone goes kind of, you know, full authoritarian and just bows to his will. But what we did see in 2017, 2018 was that he couldn't get Obamacare repealed. He didn't get any mass deportation done. What he could get done was tax cuts through budget reconciliation. I would suspect whatever you do in budget reconciliation, maybe they can get that done, which is basically spending and taxes. But broader policy reforms, that's much more difficult. And with Trump, you saw a lot of incompetence on the deregulation front, where the vast majority of deregulation moves they made got struck down by courts.
Okay, but the pushback to the larger point you're making now, whoa, I almost dropped my keyboard. The pushback to your larger point is that as David Frum said, the velociraptors have learned how to work the doors. And that's not merely about handling the deep state and purging the deep state, but it could also mean just legislatively that Republicans, and certainly Trump, maybe has a more sophisticated strategy than they had before, because Trump didn't know what he was doing, and you inherit Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell. They're not necessarily on the same page in terms of Trump's priorities. And as you mentioned, they did get tax cuts. So isn't it possible? And let me ask you this. You've already said that Democrats wouldn't blow up the filibuster. They couldn't get Tester to go along with it or whatever. Do you think that Trump could push Republicans, a Republican Senate, to blowing up the filibuster? So if it wasn't for the filibuster, you could envision a scenario where they are just ramming through legislation.
Well, that I think that is a narrowly concern, and I've seen certain Trump skeptic Republicans who say, "Well, I got to vote for Trump because the Democrats are going to pack the court and abolish the filibuster." Donald Trump is on record for abolishing the filibuster. It's Mitch McConnell that stopped him from doing that. And Mitch McConnell is not going to be the next Senate majority leader if there's a Republican majority Senate. So it is totally possible that Republicans do abolish the filibuster. And to the extent that they might fall in line with Trump, maybe they'll tack on three more positions on the Supreme Court while they're at it. How am I supposed to know?
What I'm asking is it plausible? So like, you'd still have to get John Cornyn and John Thune. And there are people who, I mean, they haven't been, I hate to say that they haven't been as strong as Mitch McConnell because, but they're somewhat, they're institutionalist to a certain degree, like Barrasso. Like,
I wouldn't count on Barrasso being the institutionalist. You know, Tillis, Romney, is Romney done?
Is he done this time? He's not running for reelection. Right. I don't know. Yeah, but that's the question. Like, how hard would it be? Is this actually, I don't want to like cry wolf here. Like, what's the likelihood that you could actually have Trump, you know, pressure these Republicans and have them actually get rid of the filibuster?
Romney is done. So we won't have Romney around.
To kick around anymore.
So like your institutionalists that are remaining, I think, are Tillis, Murkowski, Collins.
I'm going to put you on the spot. I know nothing about like parliamentary procedure and rules, but like, could the Senate majority leader simply do a voice vote and change the filibuster rules? Or would this require like a full vote? Like, how would it work logistically?
I mean, the so-called nuclear option, is a loop, because on the surface it takes 2/3 to change rules, but there is a way to essentially circumvent that with the so-called nuclear option. Forgive me for not going into all the nitty-gritty of it, because it's not fresh in my mind.
I know we haven't had to have these conversations for years, and now it's like, you know, we can do this via reconciliation. I remember that.
I mean, part of it is that if you're going to raise a point of order and say, "Hey, you're violating the rule that says rule changes are 2/3, but your party controls the Senate, whether it's this whoever's sitting in that chair, whether it's the vice president as president of the Senate or the other Senate presiding officer, they'll say, I reject your point of order. We can do this rule change. And so you just do it. So you can sort of assert majoritarian rule. It's rarely done because people are like, I can do it today. It's going to bite me in the ass tomorrow. So let's not go there. That's what they call the nuclear option, because it changes the entire character of the Senate. It effectively has been done occasionally. I mean, they did do that to get rid of the filibuster. Democrats did get rid of the filibuster for lower court judges and executive branch appointments. Republicans did it for Supreme Court confirmations. But they've been hesitant to do it for all legislation. You know, they created this budget reconciliation procedure. I don't think that was done in a majoritarian way, but they created it as a way to weaken the filibuster for a narrow set of types of laws. Would they go the extra mile here? Would there be, because I think even the best case scenario, let's say Brown loses and Tester loses, and they're going to take West Virginia. So I think that gets you to 52. Am I right?
Uh-huh.
I think it'd be 52 Republican.
It's 50-50 with West Virginia. It becomes 50-50 with West Virginia. And then if you lose Ohio and Montana, it's 52.
Right. So if Murkowski, Collins, Tillis says, no, I'm not going to do that, then they're not going to do that. But that requires a lot of gumption on their part to withstand what kind of heat President Trump would put on them. So in that respect, I think it's possible we go that full authoritarian in that sense. Everybody salutes, but the past record was some folks say, you know what, I don't have to do what you want to do. I live in a more. But now the area to go back to Frum though, I think the area to be worried most in terms of the velociraptors have learned to work the doors. That's foreign policy. That's where Trump can really go hog wild and be very hard for it to be constricted by Congress. And that can be very unsettling.
Oh, yeah. Totally. Ukraine, Russia, that kind of thing, which huge ramifications of this election. Scale of 1 to 10, though. 10 being, yes, Republicans would kill the filibuster. 1 being, no, it never going to happen. Where are you on that scale?
I mean, I probably lean against it.
So you're a 4, maybe.
Yeah, I'd say maybe a 4. I mean, it depends on whether there is a piece of legislation that is so important to Trump and so important to the base that they put just an insane level of pressure.
Yeah, it doesn't happen in the abstract. There has to be something that they want to do.
Yeah.
Maybe there's the perception that it's being obstructed,
right.
Obstructionism.
The thing about Trump's platform, and this, and I'm not talking Project 2025. I'm talking about what Trump has said himself. It's not very legislative. It's a lot of I'm just going to fix it. How are you going to stop transgender rights in schools? You just ban it. You just do it. So I just don't know much he's going to care about. Now, I'm not saying there are things that
J.D. Vance and Steve Miller get together. They could start filling that out and selling Trump on it. So,
you look at Project 2025. There's another project that's, I think it's America First Legal, I think it's called. I'm sure there's lots of things in the Beltway Trump world where there's lots of legislative ideas being percolated. What we don't know is how far Trump is going to say, okay, this one's my priority and I'm going to try to really jam it down their throats, even though we would have to abolish the filibuster to do it. That's a little more uncertain.
And you mentioned foreign policy, a lot of discretion for the president there, very serious stuff. Tariffs. He can unilaterally do tariffs, right?
I'm not perfectly knowledgeable. I think there's some tariffs he can do himself. I don't know if he could go across the board by himself or not. I haven't looked into it. But we know maybe that's something. Well, and that's something I think you could do with the reconciliation. Because that's taxing. I mean, that's revenue raising. I also might be the kind of thing where, if someone wanted to say, the Senate parliamentarian says you can't do it, well, then you get 50 votes to overrule the parliamentarian kind of thing.
And then you've got executive orders, which he's going
to... I know there's some executive order power to do certain tariffs. So
let me now come full circle. I want to push back. I think that we have undermined your premise of your piece is that Kamala is going to get more done.
Well, more. I still think more. The things that Kamala can get done are things that are more likely to stick. Anything that's done on a party line basis, if the pendulum swings the other way, can get undone. So between the two.
Yeah. And by the way,
I think she'd be more successful.
I think this has been a missed opportunity for her when she gets pressured about the border, right? And she says, we had this legislation and President Trump sabotaged it. And they say, President Biden signed these or revoked these executive orders or whatever. And I think there's an opening for her to say, here, that's the problem. Every president comes in and then the next guy can reverse those executive orders. Mm-hmm. And so what we really need to do is focus on legislation that will secure the border, regardless of who, I guess it's hard to say that.
Well, she has effectively said that in terms of immigration. She hasn't gotten that deep in the weeds on executive order versus legislation, but she has, she has not spent, neither one mentions very often that Joe Biden just did an executive order that has dramatically cut down the number of illegal border crossings. I mean, literally, we were at 300,000 Southwest border apprehensions in December, and it's down to 100,000 in September. I don't know if you want to get into the immigration piece. I don't know if you want to dive into that.
Let's talk about that, right? Because here's something else. We talk about what could Trump get done? What would he get done? And if past is prologue, Donald Trump, he is not new to the idea of mass deportations, but how did it actually pan out last time around?
I mean, what I find so crazy is one of the big knocks that Trump and Vance always put on Harris is, you promising all these things, why didn't you get it done? You're vice president now, why didn't you get it done? And she doesn't really engage that line of argument because it gets you, I think the answer to it is, we got a lot of things done. No president gets everything done. We got done what we could get done. Here's the things I would like to do next to build on what we accomplished. And as far as the things that I think maybe more important what Joe Biden did, well, I'm the vice president, not the president. So he set these priorities. He got these things done. I want to do these things. That's a lot to get into. So she just ignores it and just stays in her own narrative.
If you do a really good job of that, you're reminding people that you're part of the Biden
administration. Exactly. Yeah, which she's not trying to emphasize. Yeah. Donald Trump in 2016 said he was going to do mass deportations. In 2016, he said he was going to emulate, President Eisenhower's Operation Wetback. That's literally the name, Operation Wetback. So excuse me for using a racist term. That's what it was called. He even specifically promised that on day one, he would begin deporting 2 million criminal immigrants. Now, there's estimated about 11 million undocumented immigrants at that point and today. But he made it more precise promise of 2 million. And when you compare interior deportation, so, it's one thing to catch them just across the border and to send them back. You're talking about a mass deportation. You're talking about people who have been here, who have built up lives here. So the interior number is more indicative of your success rate there, to use an imperfect term. Excuse me for pulling up my article, so I give you the exact number here. So George Bush had about 1 million interior deportations, and Barack Obama had about 1.2 million. Now, they had 8 years. But still, Trump had 326,000 in 4 years. So that is not just less than Obama or Bush, but a lower pace, significantly. If he had 8 years, he would have ended up at, 650. He would not have hit a million. Where he had a bit more success was on legal immigration. And some of that was pandemic related because he really almost totally clamped down on green card issuances after the pandemic. Some of it was slow walking the visa process. Even when you talk about, you've seen this chart, you love some of this chart. that he shows at his rallies, and if it, and the charts were made him turn his head in Butler, Pennsylvania, and so the bullet only, you know, grazed his ear. So he thanks the chart for saving his life. Philip Bump of the Washington Post did a good analysis of that chart, and you can look at it more closely. It tracks the number of Southwest border apprehensions on a monthly basis. That number on Trump's watch goes up and up and up. 2017, 2018, 2019. It's a little bit of a dip in 2018, but the overall trajectory is up. And it only starts going down. It goes down some before the pandemic, but still at an elevated level. And then it really goes down at the onset of the pandemic, because you have this Title 42, which is a public health emergency power that you have to process the asylum claim and you send them back. And so for a brief time in the earlier part of the pandemic lockdown, the number was below where it started with at the beginning of his presidency. But at the tail end of 2020, that number goes back up again fairly significantly. Now with Biden, it goes up a lot. You know, we had a record surge on Biden's watch, and you know, Trump would say it's Biden's fault. I would argue it has to do a lot of external factors involving the post-pandemic and turmoil in other countries. But be that as it may, it's harder for Democrats to say, you screwed up the border. Look, because they don't have a great argument in terms of, you know, just the top line number. But in terms of assessing Trump's own success rate based on what the numbers were when he came in, he failed to accomplish the mass deportations that he promised he would do on day one. If the knock on Biden's executive order is, well, what took you so long? Well, what took Trump so long? I mean, he did try things. He did have family separation. It's not like he wasn't trying. I mean, he did cruel stuff. You know, ICE was doing some, you know, raids, but it was kind of for show. It didn't have the actual impact on the numbers that Trump was saying that it would. It hurt people. I'm not saying it was innocuous. Their individual lives were impacted by it. But it didn't actually accomplish what Trump said he was going to accomplish. And I don't see any reason why would ICE, who has I think 30,000 people or so, how are they going to deport upwards of 11 million people? They said they're going to bring up the National Guard. That's one of the things that said the National Guard's going to do it. There's no evidence that is as easy as it sounds. In fact, CBS had a report where they talked to one of Trump's immigration aides and was asked point blank, is there a written plan how these deportations can be executed? And he said, I haven't seen one. Whereas with Harris, at least you can say there is a plan. It's the bipartisan border bill that was negotiated in the Senate that she says, I'm going to take it off the shelf and get it passed. And if she had a Democratic House, an anomaly Democratic Senate, maybe you could pick off, you know, 8-9 Republicans. You might need 10. I think that's somewhat foreseeable in a world where Trump is sidelined. Because it's still a pretty conservative bill that was put on the table there. So I think Harris is more positioned to actually get something done on immigration than Trump is.
Sadly, I don't think Trump will be sidelined even if he loses. But that is another conversation. I did write a piece a couple weeks ago saying Trump will run again no matter what happens.
Said he wouldn't. He actually said he wouldn't if he lost.
But he said that every time.
Did he say that? I don't know. I don't know if he has said that previously.
No, he has.
Okay. All right.
Well, so now we've talked about, you know, maybe some of the stakes. You want to shift to our predictions and close it out?
We haven't talked about the garbage stuff. But I think we should
do that. You want to do some trash talk?
So let me ask you, Matt.
Okay.
When the whole basket of deplorables things happened, if I remember correctly, mm-hmm. you know, I think you immediately saw the damage that could do. You're a real American, Matt. Rural American, yeah. West Virginia strong now. You go to church, you love your country, you eat red meat, you listen to country music. So you know when Hillary said that was going to cause a problem. Am I remembering correctly?
Yeah, I mean, I probably didn't know that it would come to define her, but then again, no one knew that she would lose. You know, I think if she wins that race, it's more of a blip, right?
Right.
But yeah, it's predictable that was a gaffe and a problem, but it really became a big problem.
So from my vantage point, when we heard the anti-Puerto Rican, anti-Latino comments from the warm-up speakers, particularly the comic Tony Hinchcliffe, we saw that really take off in the media. We saw reaction from famous and respected Puerto Ricans who immediately came out to criticize Trump and even endorse Harris, or in the case of Nikki Jam yesterday, rescind his endorsement for Trump. We saw Puerto Rican newspapers endorse Harris. I saw John King go to Nevada and talk to Latinos, saying, you know, they're talking to a guy like runs the Spanish language radio station. He's like, oh yeah, my switchboard's lighting up. You know, this has got everyone's attention. And then you have Joe Biden step on Harris's, I think, very well-executed closing argument speech, you know, at the Ellipse. Now, perhaps unintentionally, I don't know where you are, what you think he meant to say, but at minimum, it came across to some as besmirching, calling all of Trump supporters garbage. My gut reaction is, you know, not ideal for Harris, blew a news cycle. It should have been in her favor, and news cycles are precious right now. But I don't think there's any swing voter that's going to look at that and not only say, one, I think Biden is insulting me personally, and two, I think Harris agrees with it. If you're a Trumper, sure, you're going to take it that way, legitimately or disingenuously, and try to milk it. But I don't think it has the same resonance that a actual presidential candidate doing it and doing it in a far more explicit way than what happened with Biden. But Mr. Real America, Matt Lewis, what was your reaction?
Well, first of all, I'll say that this pissed me off so much. I've pledged I will never support Joe Biden for president. Just as I will never vote for Hunter Biden for president, I'm now never voting for Joe Biden or supporting Joe Biden. So point well taken, Bill. I will say this, and you're also right. News cycles are precious right now. It really stepped on, I think, the momentum that Harris had just kind of regained. So if you care about winning news cycles and all that, and I do, it was unhelpful. I think the problem here is not that this persuades anybody, right? This isn't going to change anybody's mind. See, the Puerto Rican gaffe, the gaffe about calling Puerto Rico trash, that actually could change votes, persuade people to change. The Joe Biden gaffe, I don't think, changes any minds. But what it does is, it's like bulletin board material in football. Trump now will use this gaffe to motivate turnout. And so the way that Trump wins is by turning out unlikely voters, the kinds of people.
I guess that's my question. Do you think there's someone who wasn't already going to show up for Trump, who is now going to show up for Trump because somebody who was not on the ballot said this kind of garbled thing that can be interpreted negatively?
I do. I mean, not millions, but if we're talking about a game of inches, and this is a very close election, and Trump's whole strategy, the way he wins, is by turning out disgruntled voters disgruntled Americans who are unlikely voters, this does that, right? And I'm not saying it's going to do it with all of them or even most of them, but I would imagine that this, if nothing else, this gives Trump and his team a closing message for those people that could anger them and inspire them.
I remain skeptical it pulls someone off the sideline. But we'll see. I mean, this gets into another aspect, which is ground game. Do you have an operation that is built to find those people and get them off the sideline? I mean, we just had a big article in Wired yesterday. I mean, people who've been watching us or reading me know this has been my hobby horse subject since June, where I telegraphed from the get-go that Trump's get the vote strategy was going to be a cluster, and every subsequent report has backed that up. And the story in Wired, there were two yesterday by Jake LaHut.
Yeah, two big stories in Wired. Who knew that Wired still existed?
Workers say they were tricked and threatened as part of Elon Musk's get out the vote effort. In Michigan, canvassers and paid door knockers for the former president contracted by a firm associated with America PAC have been subjected to poor working conditions. A number of them have been driven around in the back of a seatless U-Haul van, according to video obtained by Wired, threatened that their lodging at a local motel wouldn't be paid if they didn't meet canvassing quotas. One door knocker alleges they didn't even know they were signing up for anything having to do with Musk or Trump. But even with that, there's not evidence that it's actually producing quality work. They're hitting their targets. There's lots of evidence that these folks are not, getting the job done. So I think for what you're saying to be true would mean that people would have to get off their own couches because they were so personally motivated, not because someone knocked on the door and got them out. They would say, "I'm so mad at Joe Biden for doing this that I'm not going to vote for Trump when I was going to take a nap instead."
Well, but here's the thing, Bill. You can't, in the course of a week, five days or whatever we have left, you can't build a get-out-the-vote operation that identifies, voters who will vote for you if they show up and then make sure that they get a phone call and make sure that someone visits their door and that there's a bus or a van. You can't pull that off in a week. What you can do is incite moral outrage. And Joe Biden did that for them. He helped Republicans. He helped Donald Trump. It was a completely unforced error. He handed them this gift. Does it overcome a well-run campaign and a logistical turnout operation? I don't know. But it is totally unforced error. And there's so many things. If Harris loses, this is one of the things we look back to, just like the James Comey press conference or whatever, right? The laptop, the Wiener laptop. And if Trump loses, maybe we look at the Puerto Rico thing. And the truth is, neither of those gaffes or incidents, whatever we want to call them, may in fact have been dispositive. But in the closing days, I think we look back at those moments and say, if nothing else, they're indicative of the problem, right? So if the kind of campaign that will put a insult comic on stage a week before the election, that's indicative of larger problems. Similarly, the kind of campaign that will insult the voters, knowing what we know now, we have been through this. We have been through deplorables. We have been through the 47%. We know you don't do this. And Joe Biden did it right before the election.
Oh, what's very strange about it, again, I think it's very, very possible that's not what Joe Biden intended to do. That he was not trying to talk about Trump supporters broadly. It was just this one guy, this Trump supporters, apostrophe S, demonization. We'll never know for sure. I do find it, Biden has always been Mr. Lunch Pail Democrat. He was the guy saying in 2016, we should not be disparaging of people who are inclined to vote for Trump. So it's never really been in his character to go there.
But he does insult people. He calls people fat. He tells people he's smarter than them. He's first in his class.
He's not Mr. Warm Fuzzy. He can be ornery, no doubt. And clearly, where everything is happening with him, neurologically, there is evidence that when people age, they can become more irritable and more unfiltered. But to take a swipe at sort of working class America has not been the Joe Biden we've known for the past 50 years. So I'm inclined to think he was not trying to go there. But your point is well taken that he still said something that was close enough to the line that he admittedly blew a news cycle and hurt Kamala's ability to really drive home her message in the closing days. Whether it is determinative or not, you'll never be able to fully prove it. But we will be able to look at turnout patterns in different pockets of these key states. There's definitely white rural pockets of Pennsylvania, and there are Puerto Rican pockets of Pennsylvania. We would look at those numbers, the turnout levels, the splits, and be able to make some judgments there. And I think it's going to be very hard where poll data is still coming in, not super robustly, quite frankly. But I think it's going to be pretty hard for pollsters to capture how these things might move the needle. It's pretty hard to get quality Latino subsamples on a good day because it's, they're not, 25% of Pennsylvania. Yeah. They're like, I think like five or six.
And there's early voting. A lot of people have voted before these
Sure, but if you're early voting for the most part, I think you're probably pretty firm. I mean, when you're, it's the stragglers, the undecideds are going to come in late, where these things might have.
But the Puerto Rican, that's not necessarily true of the Puerto Ricans.
I heard one anecdote. I mean, I don't know if it's even true. But someone put on X that there was someone who was Latino who went to their polling station and said, "I want to change my vote," and obviously can't do that. But I think on the whole, there's probably not that much like that. I think it's more a question of people who are kind of on the fence, and I don't think. The polls that come, maybe we'll get some polls on Sunday that were sampled, you know, Wednesday to Friday, that might get some of that. But I think generally you probably need a little bit more distance from the event to really get a sense of how it's being absorbed. And so something that might really kick in by Tuesday, for example, you might not get captured a poll that came out on Sunday. So I think we're kind of flying blind with the data here.
Well, we are, and if the Biden gaffe plays into Trump's strategy of turning out unlikely voters, it probably wouldn't even show up in polls anyway. It shows up on election day, not in the polls. We wouldn't be warned. So, you mentioned Wired Magazine, Bill. There's a coffee shop in Georgetown, and they, you know, early on they had Wi-Fi and they sell baked goods, and it's called Baked and Wired. And that's how I'm feeling, right? hitting into this anxious time of year. But I guess we've done enough throat clearing to move on now to the much anticipated. We call him Bill, Mr. October Share, around here. We have moving into our.
I think you're going to call Mr. May
prediction.
Dave Winfield.
It's Reggie Jackson, right?
No, Winfield. Reggie was Mr. October. Steinbrenner called Dave Winfield Mr. May. That was the big.
Oh,
no,
Mr. May.
That was the big snub that he spent all his money on Dave Winfield. He was no Reggie Jackson.
All right. I once wrote a column many years ago comparing Donald Trump to George Steinbrenner. And there were eerie similarities other than the obvious. But anyway, check that out. It's at the Daily Beast if you can get to it. Let's go ahead, Bill. I'm going to let you go. I'm going to let you finish. I'm going to let you go first. Do you want to do Senate or just presidential today?
I can do both.
Okay. Let's hear. And I have no idea what Bill's going to say. And in fact, it's possible we will say the same thing, which would be very anticlimactic. But Bill, take it away.
Well, you know, my argument has been, I had two main arguments all along. One is that this is not an economy that fells incumbents historically. Yes, there's inflation hangover. Yes, there's still frustration. I know the poll data says about people's satisfaction with the economy. But an economy with rising GDP, low unemployment, wages beating inflation, we don't have examples of incumbent parties losing with that. I will make one, except, you know, in times of war, you know, if there's an unpopular war, that could supersede that. The one other example you could point to undercut my argument is 1960, I believe. I think the economy was a little iffy, but I do think there was a pretty big gap in Eisenhower versus Nixon in terms of public popularity. Eisenhower was a beloved general who was kind of seen as transcending party, and Nixon was more of a conservative Republican, and the country really was not all that conservative at the time. I would asterisk that, but if you want to push back on me, I think it's probably your best pushback. I think the economic fundamentals are in the Democrats' direction, and to the extent that it's a close race, if it's going to be a close race, I think the GOTV edge goes to the Democrats for all the reasons that were previously stated. So I'm looking at, you know, straight poll data; it's all coin flips. And if I was going to do straight 538 or Real Clear Politics poll average, I think there's enough like Trump at like 0 point whatever to give him the Electoral College. But within that margin of error, I treat that all as statistical dead heat. And I would say I'm going to give Harris the edge in those circumstances with the ground game edge. So that leads me to predict a 270-268 Electoral College. Rust Belt only, Rust Belt plus Nebraska 2, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. I was a little tempted to throw in North Carolina for Harris on those grounds. but it's been such it's been a bit of a white whale for Democrats to date. I mean, the collapse of the Mark Robinson gubernatorial campaign, I think, could possibly help them there. But I wasn't quite prepared, since there's just no track record of Democrats, you know, eking out a close vote there. So I'm not going there. And Nevada, I could also say there is evidence of Democrats pulling out close races in Nevada. The venerable Reid machine has Democrats often overperform polls in Nevada, and you know, whereas a lot of places you'd say Democrats underperform polls, Nevada's the opposite. But if you look at, I'm gonna try to pull this up on my phone quick. If you look at where the states shifted between 2016 and 2020, so Nevada went blue both times, whereas Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin flipped to blue, and Arizona and Georgia flipped to blue. So if I compare the margin change in all those states compared to 2016, Pennsylvania moves the Democrats a little under 2 points. Wisconsin moves the Democrats about a point and a half. Michigan moves the Democrats about three. Arizona almost four, and Georgia over five. Nevada doesn't move at all. The margin stays the same. It actually goes a minuscule edge towards Trump, actually 0.03 percentage points. So, and this is at a time when almost the entire country, almost every state gets a little bit more blue. So that suggests to me that Nevada is a trending red state. It's also a state that was the one place where Republicans flipped a gubernatorial seat in 2022. So, and we've seen, if you follow John Walston's analysis, early vote numbers, Republicans are doing much better in early vote than they had before. That's true in a lot of places, and there is a debate whether this means they're expanding their vote or just cannibalizing election day vote. My suspicion is that's probably more the latter in most places. But considering these other Nevada factors, I am inclined to say that's one state that's going to flip to Trump this time around. And that's why I landed at 270, 268. Okay. In terms of should we save Senate for afterwards?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll go president. Okay. So I think that if the weird thing is we've got these seven swing states, but if the polls are wrong by a couple points in Kamala's direction, then Trump could run the table and win all seven, right? And vice versa, right?
Right.
There's a scenario where it's not even close electorally,
right?
Where somebody wins all seven states by a point or something like that.
Correct.
And so you could end up having it not look close at all. It would be not Reagan-esque, but it would be a decisive victory for somebody, even though it was so close. What I hate to say, though, is that this is very anticlimactic, because I have exactly the same prediction that you made, which is I think Trump wins all the Sun Belt states,
right,
and Harris wins by virtue of the Rust Belt, the blue wall. What's dangerous about it is Pennsylvania. That's the scariest part of this,
yep,
the part that I'm the most anxious about. As you know, I felt early on like Harris should have picked the governor of that state. And if she ends up losing narrowly because she didn't, that will be a shame for her. I also think it's a little dangerous, because if you and I are both right, but if Pennsylvania is close, my recollection is that Pennsylvania is not great at counting votes
heavy litigation. And I'm sure multiple states that's going to, and Trump will do everything in his power to, inject uncertainty and into the whole process. It's going to be very, very messy.
If you and I are right, we could have a scenario where it's once again a disputed victory, and Pennsylvania, the, you know, Philadelphia, people that don't even live in Pennsylvania, but Philadelphia, and, you know, all this. So it could get ugly.
Yep.
It could get crazy.
Well, two things I want to add. Yeah. When I forgot to mention, I do think the Puerto Rican issue is also the one more point in Harris's favor in Pennsylvania. You know, Trump, yep, I think, has done a little bit better in recent Pennsylvania polling, but it's not probably capturing potential shifts in the Latino population there.
So I think thousands of Puerto Rican voters in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. To your point about the post-election aftermath, Trump has not put the same amount of money into get out of the vote operations as integrity operations. He has geared up for a massive legal fight post-election. That's what he wants to do. And you keep in mind, he was talking about the election being rigged all through October in 2016. It's not like he just suddenly came upon this idea after he lost in 2020. He has always tried to inject illegitimacy into the process the first time he ran. Like, that is his MO completely.
Yeah,
he
does this before debates.
Yes.
Debates are rigged.
He does it before the Emmy Awards.
Before trials, court trials.
Yes.
It's rigged before the decision's handed down, and he does this for elections.
And I think in 2016, it was something that was a little unnerving, but you kind of waved it off because he's not even going to win anyway. And where's this going to go after 2020? You know, oh, now I see how far he's going to take it. He's literally going to foment insurrection. And now it's going to be backed up with even more. He did a plenty of litigation in 2020, but I think it'll be even more so this time around. So, yeah, I can't say I'm looking forward to a stress-relieving post-election atmosphere, even if Harris wins. But you and I appear to be on the same page in terms of where we think this is going to go.
Okay, let's go quick. But Senate, where are you at?
Republicans, 51-49. I think Sherrod Brown pulls out Ohio. Tester loses Montana. No upsets in Florida and Texas. I hate to be a downer there. I don't discount the possibilities. I'm not saying none of these predictions for me, and I'm sure for you, are said with unequivocal certainty. There's plenty of room for uncertainty here. I do think for Allred to pull out of Texas would require a bit more of a blue wave than you and I are anticipating. But if that happens, sure, it could happen. And I mean, Montana seems to be like Nevada in that they've had an influx of conservatives population-wise that are making their states redder. So if Tester's to pull it out, one has to be not true or not completely true, and Tester's got the better GOTV, and some of the stuff with Xi about him not telling the truth about his war wounds somehow kick in. But all the polling there has been, you know, pretty poor for Tester. And so I'm inclined to think that these are just places that have just gotten redder. Texas, I do think, is getting bluer. There's just not a lot of evidence to the point that it's getting blue enough to actually tip over in this election. But, you know, if there is this kind of super charm, maybe Latinos in Texas are mad enough about what happened in Madison Square Garden that they would come out bigger than they did. I mean, they kind of drifted rightward in 2020. So if there was to be a surprise, that's where the surprise would be. But I'm not going to go as far as to actually predict it.
I don't know whether, like an old married couple, we're getting more and more alike or whether we're both falling prey to conventional wisdom, Bill, but that's exactly my take, too. It's not great TV.
Well, I think these aren't like brave out of the box predictions. They're pretty much tracking what, you know, polls say.
I should have gone hard and just predicted Trump last minute just to make it more interesting. But that's okay. We've got a lot of crazy. There's enough craziness. People can come here for, you know, the soothing conventional wisdom of political prognostications.
You think Sherrod pulls it out?
I do. But, you know, I could be talked out of that. But, yeah, that's my gut right now. So I think it's very narrow.
What do you
51.
Think about I have noticed that Tammy Baldwin losing a little bit of altitude in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And it appears that, you know, the Republican there, Hovda, I think his name is pronounced, is running ads attacking Baldwin for he would say he's not attacking her for being gay. She's not married. She doesn't have a domestic partnership, but she has a girlfriend. Her girlfriend works in banking or Wall Street in New York. And so he's been accusing her of being of not properly regulating the industry because she has a conflict for having this girlfriend. And, you know, the Democrats saying they're trying to be homophobic and calling attention to her sexual orientation. They go, oh, no, I'm just talking about, you know, her her policies. She's not even on the banking committee. You know, she doesn't have like, direct responsibility over these things. I'm not even sure they're important.
Is this like when John Edwards congratulated Dick Cheney on his gay daughter or something?
Well, Karen,
you've been so great about that.
Yeah. So that may have drawn a little blood there and made those polls narrow. But considering I think Harris is going to pull out Wisconsin, I don't see Harris winning Wisconsin and Baldwin losing Wisconsin.
I think you're right. And did I just slur John Edwards? Was that him or was that Lieberman? I think it was Edwards, right? Do you remember that?
Well, Kerry made a comment in the debate with Bush. But it's possible Edwards said something, too, in the vice presidential debate.
All right. I apologize if I've gotten it wrong, but, you know, here we are. Bill, always a pleasure. Anything people should read your stuff at the Washington Monthly? Anything else you want to plug?
Yeah, Washington Monthly, my immigration column today, my piece on Tuesday about who get more done. I will have the newsletter come out today. They'll have the latest gender gap tracker numbers. So you can subscribe to that via email through the WashingtonMonthly.com website or through our Substack page. I also recently did a podcast. I've gone on Justin Robert Young's Politics podcast. We did an overview a few days ago, so feel free to check that out as well.
Very cool. Check out my latest at The Hill, which is about why Christians can vote, actually, for Democrats. It doesn't necessarily send you straight to hell if you vote for a Democrat. Check that out. Also, David Frum and Will Salatan both have been guests on the pod this week. My show, Matt Lewis Can't Lose. Check that out. Batten down the hatches. Stay tuned. Stay safe.
Hey, one last question for you, Matt.
Yes, sir.
I was struck by that column of yours. We should have talked about this more. Are you voting Democratic?
I probably won't because it doesn't even matter in West Virginia. But I will say this, Bill, if I lived in a swing state, one of the seven, I would vote for Kamala Harris this year.
Wow.
Yeah, I would. But I don't see the need to do it because, as you can imagine, there are a lot of things about Kamala Harris and her policies that I don't like and that I don't really want necessarily to endorse and be complicit in. And since I don't have to, I'm not gonna, probably. But if my vote mattered, then I would go with the lesser of two evils in my mind, and I would vote for democracy.
Wow. The journey of Matt Lewis is fascinating. That was a great column, and you should folks should definitely check out that column.
Yeah, I feel like it didn't get, I don't know if it's because it was at The Hill, whereas, you know, usually the stuff I write at The Hill is more horse racy, and that piece was a little more philosophical, theological. I wonder if it had been at The Beast, you know, if it had popped more, because I think it was an underrated column. So please check it out. The cool thing about it being at The Hill is there's no paywall. So you could read my stuff now for free. And that wasn't always the case. So do check that out.
Excellent. All right.
All right.
I'll see you on the other side, Matt.
It's going to be crazy. Next time I see you, it's going to be wild. And we will have lots to talk about, I am sure. So stay tuned. See you, Bill. All right.